Eye on Careers.
In association with LeMoon.com. Jobs, courses, and all things career.
Welcome to Eye on Careers. I'm your host, Shane Phillips. I thought this song was appropriate, seeing as we're out of the financial crisis. Dubai's hitting stride. I have not visited a business in the last month that isn't hiring. So, feels a lot better than it did in 2009, let me tell you that. And if there's one area of the world you want to be in, I've got to tell you, I think Dubai's got to be the city of the 21st century. So if you're out there, you want to get a little bit of an edge on the corporate game, you're listening to the right show, because at Eye on Careers, we look at the region's biggest success stories. Not only that, we find out what made them successful. So if your career is just not going your way, if you just don't feel like you're realizing your potential, or maybe you want an edge, this show is for you. I want to send a big thanks out to Paul Kenny and Peter Sliboon from Cobone.com. They came out to our leadership event last Tuesday. I mean, this guy was making 3,500 dirhams in 2010. By 2013, he sells his company for $40 million to Tiger Global. And he doesn't stop there. He just launched Triperna.com, which is delivering 30% growth week on week, gross revenue growth. That's their top line, is growing by 30% a week. Not one winning.com business. He's got two on the go. And these guys were literally broke as a joke in 2010. He got a flat tire in his Wrangler. He couldn't afford new tires. Well, he's got new tires now. Let's just say he's not worried about his tires anymore. So it's really one of those times in the world where it's easier to create wealth and acquire wealth than it's ever been for any other generation in the history of the world. So if you're depressed, if you're down, if you things aren't going your way, you got to pick yourself up, because 2014 could be your year. We have a bang up show planned for you. This episode of Eye on Careers is really amazing. Our closer is Faisal Hussain, Chief Executive Officer of Synchron. This company was non-existent in 2000. 2001, he starts the company. Today, he's got over 4,000 employees in 9 countries. Gross revenue, $200 million. Hello. So, you know, this is amazing, and we have also, we're going to open the show with one of the biggest CEOs in the region, one of the biggest family offices. I mean, this guy is, the business is so huge, I don't even think you can wrap your head around it. You know, I think when a company's worth more than several billion dollars, I mean, how can you even visualize how big that is? He's operating in dozens and dozens of countries. He started his career off with a first class education. He was a top executive at HP. We're going to hear the story of Constantine Salome, Group Chief Executive Officer of Al Ghurair Investments. I mean, we all know Al Ghurair, a legend in town. I think they own a Mashreq Bank, just to name one of the many, many assets that these guys, a foundation stone in the economy of Dubai. And I'm really excited to have Constantine on the show with us. But before we start, why don't we just hear a little bit more about his background and give you just ramp you up to everything that this guy has done. I'm telling you, this is one show you don't want to miss. If there's a minimum one or two tips that are going to help you move your career forward, going to help you make more money, help you deliver a better standard of living to your family, it's this one. So here's the bio of Constantine Salome, Group CEO of Algorare Investments.
Eye on Careers, Executive CV.
Constantine Salome is the Chief Executive Officer of Algorare Investment, a diversified Dubai-based private group with operating companies in the food, energy, real estate, education, printing and publishing, hospitality, retail, industrial and construction sectors across more than 20 countries in four continents. He has 25 years of senior cross-functional management experience with multinational companies and family businesses in the industrial, technology, private equity, retail and financial services sectors. He was the CEO of a leading Abu Dhabi-based family business and the managing director of a Geneva-based multi-billion dollar private investment group. He holds a BSc from King's College in London, an MSc from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and an MBA from Stanford Graduate School of Business. Mr. Salome held positions on boards of public and private companies in Europe, the Middle East, and Asia Pacific. He is a member of the board of Young Enterprise Switzerland, the Micro Enterprise Acceleration Institute, and the AUB Graduate School of Business.
Well, Constantine, welcome to Eye on Careers.
Great to be here, Shane. Thank you.
It's quite exciting, actually. You know, I don't think people actually realize how big the Algorare business is, and how many companies is it under the umbrella?
The group have different pillars, and these are separate pillars. You've mentioned Mashreq and Oman Insurance are two of the leading companies within the group. These are in the financial services sector. Both are publicly quoted companies, belonging majority to the family. The Algorare Investments, where I'm the CEO, focuses more on the food, retail, real estate, construction, educational, and other sectors. You have another pillar, which is ETA, which is one of the leading companies in the engineering, contracting, and facility management business. And our chairman have asked me to double hat currently as the CEO for both Algorare Investment and for ETA, which is a big mouthful but a wonderful challenge.
Wow. And but you know, it's not like you just started being successful in this type of environment. I mean, you have a long history now, over 25 years, and you were one of the top executives in HP. But how did it all start? I mean, were you taking control of kids in the sandbox early on? was it a natural leadership? Or were you, you know, one of those individuals who was a late bloomer? Like, what were you like in high school?
High school was, first I'm Lebanese, so I was brought up in Lebanon. This was before the Civil War, and went to the French Lycée over there. So had this unique mix of both having these Lebanese roots, French educated, and then went to more of an Anglo-Saxon environment, both in the UK and the US. So school was actually great fun. It was the best years in Lebanon to be in, the late 60s and the early 70s. So it was really a blooming country, blooming economy, and Beirut was extremely well positioned across the Middle East. So the whole educational tourism. So it was a wonderful place to be and a great country. Unfortunately, the Civil War afterward affected it, but it was a wonderful catalyst for a number of us as we went through this, the disruptions of going through the tough times of Civil War.
And your father, was he a businessman as well?
You know, I owe a lot to, this is probably one of the first messages I would say, is like you need to link to your roots. I mean, your roots at the end become something which is essential. And I was very privileged and lucky. I mean, I would go back to both my grandparents. My grandfather on the father's side was a very successful entrepreneur who made his fortune, and his fortune was taken away three times. One in Palestine, where he had to flee, and I carry his name, by the way. The second time was in Egypt, where after 56 it was also nationalized, and the third time was, of course, in Lebanon with the civil war. On my mother's side, he was one of the first members of the parliament back in the 20s, and he taught me a lot of the attachment, if you want, to the country and to our roots. Where on the father's side, it was much more in terms of the entrepreneurial spirit. From my father's side, when I was born, he was actually the first Lebanese chess champion, and I got a lot from him in terms of an analytical mind and problem-solving skills. And he's now 92, still very active, swims every day, walks long walks, and so being it from my father or my mother, who is now also in her 90s, and she still runs her art gallery in Lebanon, and you know, I got a lot to in terms of the love of nature, and Lebanon has a lot to offer in this respect. So from all these perspectives, I think it shaped a lot of the sort of person that I am, and of course the future and the experiences that you go through do the rest in terms of.
So this gentleman had his fortunes nationalized three times.
Nationalized the first time he was kicked out of the country. The second time was nationalized, and the third time was with the war. And he died a happy man at 103. So it's and I was privileged enough to carry his name. We have a tradition in Lebanon where the eldest son gives the name of his father to his eldest son. So this is.
So, and he made his money back each time.
He did. I mean, this is the whole thing, is that you, one of the lessons is that you, it goes, it's fine, you just start again and rebuild it. So it's, you learn a lot by being surrounded by people who have this resilience and ability to be able to emerge from the ashes and start again. So wonderful life lesson.
I mean, so many people would give up after the first time, you know, and then carry that, you know, that crutch, you know, and say, oh, I was kicked out, I had to throw my business. Is that one of the tenets of success, you think, is just continually keeping the optimism up and not letting yourself get down?
I think definitely having a high level of energy, perseverance, and basically trust in yourself, trust in the world, trust in the people that you know, because if you're motivated, motivation drives motivation, and you. So I think it's one probably of the inherent element of success is always looking at the glass half full, trying to find opportunities even in the most distressed periods that you could face in. And then you create your own luck this way. I mean, it's, yes.
Well, we're going to hear more. This is the story of Constantine Salomé, Group CEO of Al Ghurair Investments, one of the biggest companies in the entire Middle East. This is a powerhouse, and this is the top dog here talking to us live. He's going to be sharing his secrets on how he navigated the road to the top, and a lot of insights into, I'm sure, the market and how to manage your career here in the Middle East. So we'll just stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Eye on Careers. This is the show that helps you get an edge in your career, in your job, or your business, if you're a business owner. We're here with one of the biggest CEOs in the region, the biggest businesses, the Group CEO of Al Ghurair Investments, Constantine Salomé. Constantine, welcome back to Eye on Careers.
Thank you.
I just can't get enough of the song tonight. It's just
it's a wonderful song.
I think it fits so much because, you know, I'm a headhunter, but it was my real job, if you can call it that. But, you know, in the crisis, it was hell. I mean, it was bad, you know, and now I'm actually getting emails of business coming in unsolicited. And you're like, that did not happen in a long time. I mean, what are you seeing? I mean, you must have an amazing vantage point from all the businesses you run. What's your take? Is the market, are we seeing an uplift here? What's your take on the market?
Yeah, I mean, if you talk to, and I know you know, talk to a number of the CEOs around the country and the region, there's clearly an uptake, and you see it across the different sector. It's not only Dubai 2020, it's what's happening in Qatar, it's what's happening in Saudi Arabia. It's also the fact that you don't have an alternative option to Dubai in the region. I mean, the closest you'll find in Singapore, hours away from here, you know, so it is, we're really now at a time where, and Dubai has so much invested and learned from the past in order to make sure that we maintain this wave of growth and ensure that we surf it quite properly without any major bumps on it. So I'm very bullish about it. The results, of course, from the group and from other groups are validating this, and we expect this sustainable, profitable growth to continue in the years to come, and more employment opportunities to take place across the country and also across the region.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's great that we won Dubai Expo 2020, but I don't think it's the main thrust of the growth here. You know, like, how come no one's even talking about the railway? Like, when I look at the railway project, I think that's got to be one of the biggest boosts to GDP, and it's just kind of like this side story that's out there. You know, it's and there's so many. I could just continue to list nonstop all the growth drivers, but it's great that we did win Dubai Expo.
No, but you're absolutely right. I mean, Dubai 2020 catches the attention and catches because it was a big event coordinated across different departments. The government of Dubai and the UAE did a wonderful job at it. But you're right in saying, I mean, the foundation here, it's really about transportation, it's about logistics, it's about tourism, it's about trade, and it will continue to be these. Then add to it the whole hospitality and healthcare and education, which are really going to boom in the years to come. And this is part of the success story of what Dubai is today and will continue to be in the years to come.
It's exciting, but you know what? The thing that you're noticing now around the city when you drive around is the cranes are back. Like, you know, there's cranes all operating up and down Sheikh Zayed Road and in the different neighborhoods. You're starting to see that construction come back into the city.
True. I mean, not only the cranes are back, it's the queues are back, the traffic jams are back, and this is good. I mean, it's good to have these because you feel that the city is you know, full of buzz, full of passion, and it's great news to everyone here.
You know, you've been in the Middle East a long time when you're in Dubai and you get stuck in a traffic jam and it's raining and you're like, oh, this is amazing. I mean, it's a traffic jam and it's raining. And we had a good downpour the other day. But you started, I mean, you were a bright spark coming out of the gates, right? I mean, obviously, when we look at there and you see you're you know, getting in touch with your roots, you know, you had kind of giants among men in your grandfathers and fathers, and, you know, so there was some mentorship there early on. And then you go to the U.S. and you get your undergrad from King's College, and then you get your master's from MIT, and then you get your MBA from Stanford. These are amazing schools. I mean, this is the top of the top education, right?
Yeah, you know what happens is when you're in Lebanon, it's I mean, these plants these seeds were planted back when you're a school kid. So you realize, what do you want to do? I want to be an engineer. Why do you want to be an engineer? Because it's a fascinating thing. Okay, if you want to be an engineer, where do you go? And then everybody will tell you, you know, the place to go is MIT. So you're a 10-year-old. You don't even know what engineering is all about. You don't even know what MIT is. But then it grows on you. And then suddenly what you do is all these myths, you would like them to come true. So you drive at it. And then, you know, sometimes you create your own luck and then you enjoy the journey. I mean, I always keep this this example. I mean, there was a philosopher and he invented the whole concept of Viktor Frankl. He invented the concept of logotherapy, and his point of view is like, he went through a concentration camp which was pretty tough, and then he realized that the people who made it were not the healthiest or were not the youngest, but were really the people who knew that their life was not over. They had something to still achieve. And I think this in some ways was a lesson that I always kept in the back of my mind, is, why are you here? What are you trying to do? And this helps you overcome whatever obstacles you have on the path forward.
Yeah, so for anyone out there who wanted to catch up on this, I believe the book you're referencing is Man's Search for Meaning by Dr. Viktor
Frankl.
Frankl, yeah.
Yes.
Where he said, you know, to live is to suffer, to find meaning in your suffering is to survive. And that's, yeah, it's quite a powerful concept, his logotherapy. I actually enjoyed that book. But so as you come out of there, a lot of people thinking, okay, I want to go get an MBA, and then they go and they don't really pay too much attention to the brand, where other people like yourself say, okay, Stanford, MIT, you're getting that branded degree. You know, and I think it's less about what content they're teaching you in the school, because let's be honest, by the time you graduate, 50 to 70% of whatever you were taught is obsolete, right? So isn't it more about the alumni, the group that you're meeting, you know, that is a passport into the boardrooms of the world's most powerful companies?
Hey, look, yeah, you're absolutely right. I have two boys, Patrice, who's 25, and Christophe, 23. You know, Patrice just graduated with a degree in engineering, also with a major in business, and Christophe is doing his business school. I mean, at the end of the day, it's not so much because I said, Daddy, I mean, this is, some of the subjects are so boring, and you know, so I mean, they have no souls. But at the end, what they really enjoy and take from it, and what I did back 30 years ago, is really the network. It's the network with the students. It's a network with the professors. It's the ability to get in these schools. So you have to, it's all the screening processes you go through, and it's the contact with all the companies that are coming on campus to interview. So this is the real learning behind it. It's the power of networking. It's the power of really reaching out to others, and you keep these networks. I mean, the U.S. universities are well known, and they're funded, by the way. More than a third of their total budgets come from alumni who are here and shipping in order to be able to complement the other funding. So the network plays a critical role, and throughout your career, this network will help you grow, help you learn, help you reach out. So yes, you're right. It's not about the courses themselves, but it's really about the experience of networking and what you make out of it.
Right. Yeah. And I think obviously, you know, when you have world-renowned professors, or the content is also important. But you know, it's like you can even tell as the audience now is we introduce Constantine as a graduate of Stanford, as a graduate of MIT, we assume that you are intelligent, right? Versus another school, if you know Shane Phillips University, no one's heard of it. You know, it's not giving you an edge. And I think so many people just say, "I'll get an MBA," and they don't pay attention to the brand. So I think that's a great point. And you've heard it now from the horse's mouth, one of the greatest CEOs in the region. So then you go into you join HP after graduation.
Join HP. I mean, HP was very close to Stanford, so you had a very close relationship between both the two founders, Bill Hewlett and Dave Packard, who were really wonderful people, and shaped the company back in the 70s, 80s, 90s, and I had the chance to ride this HP, one of the best companies to work for in the world, and I learned during the 20 years really the wonders of the HP way, not only in Geneva when I started, but I had the opportunity to set up the HP office in Turkey. At the time it was a $5 million company, now in several billions. Also went to Asia Pacific for a period of 4 years to set up HP Financial Services, and did the same thing in Europe, Middle East, and Africa. And this was wonderful because it was at the time where you had really three crises one after the other. In the late 90s.
That's wonderful. That's great. Excellent.
Go ahead, Shane.
Going to say the gift of desperation. Sometimes you don't realize your curses are your blessings, right?
Absolutely. I mean, in this case, this was in 97, was just in Hong Kong, and we were hit with the financial crisis in Asia Pacific. And then 3 years later, we had the dot-com crisis, and a couple of years later, we had the telecom crisis. So these were events that are pretty stressful if you are at the in the eye of the cyclone, because you're really managing the intersection of technology with financial services, and you had to take positions in terms of funding new ventures, large technology project at a time where every single bank would refuse to touch with a long pole and finance any technology ventures. And so it was a wonderful learning experience. We learned it also the hard way. I mean, a number of the giants had to take hundreds of millions of write-off because of the fairly strong risk appetite that they had at a time where
what year was this?
This was, I mean, the dot-com was in 2001. The telecom bubble burst came in 2003. And HP was one of the leading partners to both dot-coms and to telecom, together with Sun, together with other companies like IBM. And we all went through the same ride and trying to manage these risks as effectively as possible.
So you joined in 1984. How long did it take before you really had accountability for P&L and you would consider yourself a true executive leader?
Yeah.
Because I just wanted to ask, because so many people try to rush their careers. So I just wanted to get a gauge on the timelines.
Yeah. When I started in 84, the first assignment was back to the roots again. So you're going to hear this theme across the interview because my first assignment was basically to take care of the distributors that HP had in the Middle East. So at the time, there was no HP office in Dubai, nor was it in Saudi Arabia, nor was it in any of the Middle Eastern countries. We had distributors, and we were managing these distributors, and it gave me the chance to visit, to travel, to understand these countries. And then from this, I moved on to basically, they said, okay, now you know about distributors, then go to Turkey, we buy this distributor, and then let's set up the HP offices. So this was my first true management experience.
A few years into it.
I joined in 84. I moved in late 87. And I was newly married. I was first management assignment. My wife was pregnant at the time, and it was probably one of the most exciting management experience that I had in a country that was really at the beginning of blossoming into one of the largest regional economic hub here in the MENA region.
This is the story of Constantine Salomé, Group CEO for Al Ghurair Investments, giving you his tips and tricks to navigating the road to the top. Stay with us. We'll be right back with more. Welcome back to Eye on Careers. I'm your host, Shane Phillips, and we're here with Constantine Salomé, Group Chief Executive Officer for Al Ghurair Investments. Constantine, welcome back to Eye on Careers.
Hi again.
It's exciting to have you on the show with everything that you've got your fingers into at Al Ghurair. What a vantage point in the market. And for those just joining us, Constantine was basically telling us how he grew up in Lebanon before the war, the golden age of Beirut, and then moved. And as the Civil War, I think, crept in, you went to the U.S. and did your schooling, undergrad in King's College Engineering, Master's from MIT, may have heard of it. It's not a bad engineering school. Did his MBA in Stanford, then joined Hewlett-Packard, or as my London Business School professors like to say, Hewlett-Packard, and worked there for about 20 years, leading international expansion and greenfield efforts. And now getting into the family businesses here in the Middle East. After everything you've done, Constantine, what really is the biggest challenge, I think, from a personal perspective? I mean, you lived all over the world. You've worked all over the world. What would you say is one of the toughest things or biggest personal challenges you ever faced?
I was lucky enough to face it probably early on in my life. I was 18, just turned 18 in September 1973. And graduated from high school and joined the army. So we did. This was the first time we had a compulsory military service in Lebanon, and this was the time when the civil war started. So we had 74 and 75. Through the army, you really see your country going to pieces. The army splitting. Then during my first year as an AUB student, we had some pretty tough moments where I was an engineering student. Our dean of engineering was shot dead in front of us on the steps of the university. The campus was shelled several times. So these were moments where when you're 18, 19, you're starting your life, you're going through some friends were were also killed during the process or were severely wounded. It really brings to you the detachment that you need in order to face these crisis situation and be able to dig in yourself. And how do you do in order to face with this absurdity of the war, the absurdity of a civil war that in a country where you felt that. So this was probably the first and maybe the strongest at a time where you're just out of high school. But it's if I look back, I think it's probably one of the moments in my life where in the life of so many of us that went through this, so it taught us to really this resilience, this persistence, the ability to adapt to different situations, how no matter how difficult and challenging they are. So probably this, from a personal perspective, these are the this 2 year period where between the age of 18 and 19 taught me a lot, and wow, to a lot of Lebanese too. Thank you.
I almost wonder if, you know, going through that, you know, and versus, you know, my upbringing, I grew up in Canada and we were just sheltered like little puppies. I didn't have any exposure to some of the stuff that goes on in other parts of the world. And, you know, what I think is, you know, you get a sense of gratitude, you know, when you're studying or you're doing your school, you're working that late night at Hewlett Packard, you know, that gratitude that you have, you know, that you have it so good. Is the sense of gratitude, you know, one of the foundation stones?
No, yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, I mentioned energy. I mentioned the, if you want, the whole motivation that you have. But empathy and gratitude are critical. No matter what you want to do in your life, I think the fact of thanking for the blessings that you have is something that we tend to not do enough of it. So, and you're right. We are. No matter how easy or tough you have, I think we with this ability to be able to thank for these blessings is a wonderful motivation and driving source moving forward. So you're absolutely right, Shane.
An attitude of gratitude, I like to say. But what's your professional life? What's the biggest challenge that you face there?
I have alluded to. I mean, these are the three crises that hit us quite strong. It was in areas where you had full P&L responsibility, and then you had to take some heavy losses. These are important learnings that makes you reflect on the ability to understand risk, manage risk, be able to size these risks, and this is critical moving forward in whatever functions you do. So this was again another lessons, sometimes tough lessons that we had to go through as a team and learn from it. So these, from a professional side, it was much more how do you go and face these crises, which were important crises in both Europe and Asia Pacific at the time.
This was during the early 2000s when you were with HP.
Absolutely, these were, yes.
I almost wonder, you know, when you look at his, you know, in the 20th century, 60% of CEOs came from sales or came from front office, and you know, now with the crises and everything else, risk is becoming at the epicenter of so many boardroom discussions. And we had Paul Trowbridge here, who is the CEO of United Arab Bank, just a couple weeks ago, and he was previously a chief risk officer. And you know, I made this prediction a couple years ago that with the new dynamics in the market, the fundamentals of what we're looking for, leadership, is changing. And now, will that shift from 60% front office, will we be seeing more CEOs or more leaders coming from shared services who have exposure to risk, who have exposure to IT, you know, some of the two big themes that we're seeing emerging here as we move forward into the next decade?
Look, you're absolutely right. I think the shift, customer facing is critical. No matter which functions you do, I think you learn a lot about the business when you have to deal with customers, treat with them, negotiate with them. This is a wonderful learning experience. But equally important is the ability to be able to build capacity. Build capacity in your organization, being it from a corporate governance point of view, being it from a framework point of view. And this, you need to have this exposure. IT is essential. Business controls are essential. Financial controls are essential, specifically in this region where you need to strengthen this foundation in order to be able to continue your profitable growth journey. So having this exposure in terms of risk management, capacity building is equally important as having the customer-facing track record that you will experience.
So what is it, you know, you went from Hewlett Packard and then you made the very, you know, speaking of risk, risque jump, leaving the you know, it's like an aircraft carrier, HP, what a beautiful corporate environment, into the Wild West of the family offices in the Middle East. What prompted you to make that jump?
You know, you have the learnings that you take at HP are there for the rest of your life. I mean, you or any other of these companies at the time that were a little bit the pioneer in terms of you know, leadership competencies and others. What made it is first the fact that it goes back to the first theme, which is back to your roots. I think the Middle East have a tremendous need for leaders that are here to be able to build on their experience across the multinationals, or being it from the banking, investment banking, private equity, large multinational, and understanding what it takes in the local culture. So you have this bridge between best practices in an Anglo-Saxon or international environment, but at the same time, what does it take in order to make it successful here? And I think having this link is quite critical. So one is back to the roots. Two is to be able to be this bridge. And three, the opportunities that you have. I mean, we mentioned when we started the show in Dubai and across the region are phenomenal. I mean, and these are here to stay. They're here over a number of years. Groups, family groups, government groups have learned a lot from what happened over the past 5 years ago and 4 years ago. And I think these sort of opportunities are available here across all the functional areas, not only at top management. And this is why you have so many Europeans, so many Americans, so many Asians interested in coming to this region, coming to Dubai, in order to be able to enjoy these opportunities.
CEO of Al Ghurair Investments, he's going to be sharing what it takes to be a success, what he looks for in a successful executive, his secrets to success, coming right up. Hello and welcome back to Eye on Careers. I'm your host, Shane Phillips, and we are listening to the story of Constantine Salamé, Group Chief Executive Officer of Al Ghurair Investments. Constantine, welcome back to Eye on Careers.
Thank you.
It's been quite a journey here. We started out in Lebanon. Things were great. And then, of course, the civil war takes over. Huge challenges as your actual university is bombed. Your dean was killed. You lost loved ones, and it was a horrific experience. But in that, the genesis of a new life, a new drive, a new sense of gratitude, and a new hunger for success as you go off to King's College to get your undergrad in engineering, and then your master's in engineering from MIT, and then your MBA from Stanford, joining the ranks of the top executives in Hewlett-Packard, and leading greenfield and expansion efforts across the world with a focus, I think, in some of the emerging market areas. And then finally taking the brave step into the family office environment, where you've kind of been a specialist for the last decade, I guess. What do you see as some of the big challenges that family offices in the Middle East are facing?
Yeah. Look, I will say family offices and family businesses. First, if you look at common denominator, all of them were launched maybe two or three generations ago by entrepreneurs, a high level of courage, a high level of risk-taking. These are initially starting in the trading field and expanded out of from trading into other sectors like real estate, like industrial or other sectors. So you will see that very entrepreneurial, a lot of creative entrepreneurship. The issue there, or the main challenge that you have among these, is how do you channel this entrepreneurship spirit from being a creative entrepreneur to being a disciplined entrepreneur? And there you have a number of common themes that are resonating across the board of family businesses in the region. One of the themes, and probably the and they're all sensitive themes, is how do you separate the family from the business? How do you set up proper governance on the family side, and how do you set up proper governance on the business side and run these separately? This is one common challenge that is taking place and that is being addressed currently across the different boards. The second challenge that you have here is how do you go about ensuring that you are focusing on your core competencies? What is core versus what is not necessarily core? hardcore. Today, these groups are diversified into maybe 40, 50, 60 different companies across more than 10 different sectors. Can you really be successful across all of these sectors? Can you be in the number one and number two position across all these sectors? Or should you choose the sectors where you feel and put all your wood behind a single arrow or a couple of arrows and then make sure that you succeed on this? This is a fundamental question that you need. What is core to this group? What is non-core? What do we do with the core? How do we go about expanding it? And what do we do with the non-core? And this is, again, another sensitive issue, because maybe out of the non-core is to be able to divest. But divesting from family businesses is something that is sometimes challenging, because there is a very strong emotional attachment with these assets that are treated like part of the family. So these are two of the many challenges that are being faced by family businesses. But they are addressing those challenges. You see a lot of discipline. You see a lot of governance initiative that are taking place. You see board opening up, having family members together with non-family members, having proper executive, proper committees to support the board. All these initiatives are really driving and making these family businesses across the region much more sustainable from a governance and from a long-term value creation point of view.
Yeah, when you look at that governance, one of the things that I feel is missing in the region, and you tell me, is that, you know, in other more mature markets, you basically have an equity play to align the management with the shareholders or the stake owners, where in the Middle East, they seem really reluctant to create that alignment. And in a sense, the ones who suffer are the owners, right? Because you have this transition, it's easy for a manager to exit the company. You don't have that alignment there. Do you feel that there's a gap in creating an alignment between the business owners and the management ranks?
I think you're absolutely right, Shane, but I think it's changing. Traditionally, what you have is you're here, you're hired, you're compensated on, and then you have a bonus, and the bonus typically is linked to a key performance indicator, which could be either net profitability or return on invested capital or whatever the board thinks is the right one. But what is missing, and what has been missing in the past, is this long-term incentive plan, where you not only you compensate the key executives for the value that is being created, that they create with their team, but most importantly is that you retain them in the group. So this is the ability, because you have a lot, you know, assignments could be a year, 2 years, 3 years, but how do you sustain a CEO or a CFO for a period of 5 to 10 years? And I think these long-term incentives are now becoming and introduced through the HR committees, the compensation committees, into the senior executive. A few groups have started a few years ago, and I believe strongly in the power of these long-term incentives, not only to be able to attract the top talents, but to be able to develop them, to make sure that their interests are aligned with the interests of the shareholders, which is basically to create value, and most importantly is to be able to retain them through period of difficult times.
I really want to just jump back quickly on the point you made about diversification, because in my mind, from a business perspective, if it wasn't for the antitrust laws that took place way back in the beginning in response to Rockefeller and Rothschild's, these tyrannical, almost psychotic businessmen, that they created this legislation to stop them from monopolizing the markets. I think that's where it's kind of the genesis of the diversification strategy came from, and then it just cascades, because legally you have these return earnings. You're not legally allowed to invest anymore in your old business. Whereas if you don't have that rule, why would you diversify? Why wouldn't you just fully integrate across the value chain and do what Rockefeller and Rothschild's and Vanderbilt than the rest of these guys, Andrew Carnegie, did? They said a monopoly is a horrible thing unless you have one, right?
Absolutely. I mean, and you in some ways, you had it here in this region. The country was relatively, is not as open as you would, but the country is opening up, and you have some of the monopolies that are existing, both from a government and from a private sector. These, if you don't have the foundation in place, these companies who have some pseudo monopoly will face big challenges in the year to come as the market opens, as the competition and as the, you know, true market economies will take place in this part of the world. So it's essential for these companies, as the market open, to make sure that they have the right foundation, make sure that they have the right talent, make sure that they have the right strategic direction that they want to go after, and in order to be able to make it. If not, then your ability to be able to stand and maintain your leadership position will be at risk.
So you're for not diversifying, for taking one segment, being number one in that niche, maybe an inch wide and a mile deep. So let's take a global position on this niche, rather than diversify across, and then, like you said, getting into 20 different non-core businesses.
Yeah, I think I'm not saying one necessarily, but I'm saying if you want to be in one or two, and I think, I don't know if it was Booz or McKinsey did a study on it, and they looked at the level of returns to shareholders from groups that are focused. Focused means one or two business versus those who are in about eight or nine different business, and you will see that there is a fairly substantial change in terms of returns to shareholders depending on the level of focus that they have. So you could be in one sectors or you could be in two or three sectors. The important thing is that there are enough synergies across these sectors so that your one plus one plus one doesn't equal three but equals four or plus than four. So creating the synergy is essential. So if you for instance in a contracting field, and at the same time you're into the engineering field and in the facility management field, one of our group is there, you have obvious synergies across these groups, and then the power of the three becomes quite a sustainable position, although you're in three different businesses, but these businesses are very closely related.
There you have it, a snapshot capsule line on corporate strategy from one of the region's greats, Konstantin Salameh, Group Chief Executive Officer of Algorare Investments. Coming up, we have Faisal Hussain, Chief Executive Officer of Syncron. This company started in 2001 from nothing, is over 4,000 staff in 9 countries with a gross revenue of over $200 million. It's an amazing success story. And coming up, Konstantin is going to give you his secrets of success. I said that last time, but this time he's really going to give you what he looks for in a successful executive, how he hires his leaders. It's going to be some really good insights here, something you don't want to miss. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
Eye on Careers.
In association with LeMoon.com, jobs, courses, and all things career.
Hello and welcome back to Eye on Careers. I'm your host, Shane Phillips, and we're here with Konstantin Salameh, Group CEO of Algorare Investments. Konstantin, welcome back.
Thank you.
It's really interesting, just talking about this strategy piece, and I think we could go on for hours about it. But nobody can actually come on this show without being asked the infamous question, which is, what's the secrets to your success?
Eye on Careers now reveals the secrets to success.
So, Konstantin, what is your secret to success?
I forgot who he was, one of my professors at Stanford, and I think it resonated in me. He said, look, in life you could be happy and you could be successful, and he defined happiness as the ability to have creative dream, and he defined success as the ability to live these dreams and make them come through. So this balance between creative dreams and ability to execute, I think, is critical. One without the other is in some ways it's not the same recipe. So success for me is to find the right balance between these creative dreams and the unique skill to be able to execute on these dreams.
Eye on Careers.
In association with LeMoon.com, jobs, courses, and all things career.
Well, that was quite different. So it's almost a bit of romanticism mixed in with the practicality, the dreamer, the technician, the doer, the action, all mixed together into one ball. Almost that magic moment when an idea moves from fantasy and crosses the line into reality. If I were that moment, is your secret to success?
I think it's one of the elements. So you need to be a dreamer, and at the same time you need to take these dreams and turn them into reality. And if you could balance these two, then I think you have it. And maybe the third dimension, if you could make it into the service to community, this would be wonderful, because then you dream, you make them come through, and then this could help others, help the community where you're in. Then you get it all. You know, it's you're a blessed man or woman.
Well, it's interesting you mention that because there's a new trend now called the B Corporation, which is a new legal entity, which basically the covenant says that we have two main responsibilities. One, yes, we're going to create value for our shareholders, but two, we're going to create value for the community. And companies have to get rated. And under this system, you know, you can't have environmental, you have environmental regulations. And it also means your supplies, that the people you're buying your supplies from for your business also have the same regulations, that everything that's going through your business is through an ethical operator. It's good for the planet. All your staff have health insurance and everything like that. Because what they do in the U.S. is say, oh, we have environmental laws, but then everything 85% of everything on the retail shelf is from China, where there's no environmental laws. So it just totally negates the fact of even having any environmental laws, right? If I can ship anything in. And they're saying now that the new generation, the millennials and all this, they're going to be the most empathetic of all time. And we're going to see this get implemented now.
No, you're absolutely right. I think the whole concept, I mean, we define it as a triple P. P is for the bottom line, for profits. The other P is really for your people. What are you doing for your people? And the third P is, of course, for the planet. So it's if I look again, I go back to my sons. You know, the at the end, it was not about the salary. If I look at the elder sons, he actually went for the company where he felt that this company is making a difference. This company, the people are really people who have pleasure in working together with them. So the values are changing, and these triple P are looking at a holistic way to not only to the shareholders but to the employees and to the community is attracting a lot of talents, a lot of new talents, and also a lot of investors who believe that this is the right way moving forward. And this concept is coming into the Middle East and is being filtrating down to board levels across different organizations.
So I could talk about that all night as well. I think every topic we touch on, it's not fair, we only get to ask a couple of questions. But I think one thing that everybody really does want to know is, how do you pick your leaders?
Everyone have their own recipe. What I'll tell you is, when I got, one of the first thing we did in, with El Rey is that we got our 100 leaders together and we said, okay, we want to hold each other responsible and accountable. What do you believe? So this was a workshop with the top 100 leaders across the group. And we said, what? And we grouped those and we grouped them into, so this was a real team effort came up with, and I think this in some ways crystallizes, what we call leadership competency. So we divided them into five different dimension. One dimension is, go back to the key to success, is that you need to be able to have this strategic mind, strategic vision, to be able to look outside the box, look externally, think strategically. This is quite important. If you want to be a leader in today's environment, it's not only about operation, it's about being able to think outside the box. So this strategic dimension is an important dimension. The second dimension linked to it is that you need to make sure that you know who your key stakeholders are, and you need to make sure you understand their needs and understand how you communicate and influence them. This is probably one of the most important and most difficult challenge that you have in leadership, is understanding your stakeholders. And these could be board members, these could be senior officials, government officials, these could be key customers, it could be across your stakeholders that you have, of course your people. So understanding and managing stakeholders is the second dimension was important. The third dimension that came in is a dimension linked to, at the end of the day, it's about team. It's about creating teams. It's about hiring the top talents. It's about developing this talent. It's about maintaining and retaining these talents and aligning them around whatever the dimension is. So this whole concept of building teams, high-performing teams, is quite important, and it's related again to your soft skills, not necessarily to your hard skills. The fourth dimension that I've mentioned again in the past was about execution. I mean, you are accountable. You're here. You need to walk the talk. You need to deliver on what you think you're going to do, and you need to make it happen. So this execution capabilities is critical. And at the center of all these four dimensions is, we need now change catalyst. All these organizations are changing. The environment is changing. Competition is becoming more and more intense. You need to understand change. You need to embrace change. You need to take your organization through change. And this takes a lot of soft skills too that would help you in order to be able to succeed. So to summarize it, a strategic mind, the ability to be able to execute on what plans you have, the ability to empower people, motivate them, the ability to manage stakeholders, and in the center of it is the being a change catalyst. Now, we are holding each one of us accountable, and when we do the evaluation at the end of the year, they are evaluating, all my direct reports are evaluating me along these dimensions. How did I perform versus these leadership dimensions? And of course, this is an integral part of their own performance and the selection criteria that we have in hiring new executives.
Well, that's really exciting. As you know, when you look at, you know, some of the trends or evolution of business over the last 50 years, you know, back in the 60s and 70s, it was centralization, standardization, because, you know, you wanted to just have the same product and the ability to recreate that. That was a speed thing. As we now move into the current moment, if I just caught some of the subtext of what you're saying, is agility really becomes the key factor, our ability to, you know, the only constant is change in the current environment. And can your leaders evoke if the change within the organization has to be greater than the change within the market, or we're going to go extinct?
You hit it right on. It goes back to, I don't know who said, the only way to survive is really your ability to be agile, to be adaptable, your ability to adapt to whatever changes are coming in the organization, in the environment, competitive environment, and your ability to be able to see these changes coming in. So this is what would make the successful leaders in the future, is this foresight that they have and this resilience that they have in terms of adapting to different environment and different competitive situations. So you have it head on in terms of the critical, if you want, leadership skills that we look into leaders in this part of the world and overseas, of course.
One of the exciting changes you're seeing now is that billionaires are getting younger. Millionaires are getting younger. And I was sitting with Paul Kinney and Peter Slaboon from Kabone.com, and we were talking about how companies now are going from nothing to billion-dollar businesses, like Groupon within 5 years or something. It becomes a billion-dollar company. We know the story of WhatsApp and et cetera. And so I said, you know, are we going to start to see, you know, will the sub-30 self-made billionaire or self-made millionaire be a commonality? And Paul and Peter are like, you know, it'll be sub-20. Will be the commonality, you know, and you're going to start to see people who are under 15 becoming millionaires, because there's no barrier to entry. You can, at the click of a, within 3 months, you can put your product in 50 countries like that.
True. I mean, the power of technology, this open environment that we have drives a lot of this. But at the end of the day, it's really not only about billions or the millions that we've been making. It's really about the difference that you are making to the people that you're working with, to the customer that you're working with. And I think this is also another theme that you have alluded to in the past. It's being your billions, but at the end of the day, what are you doing for the rest of the community? And this theme is probably one what will be coming back again, especially for people that have, you know, now have been working for the past 35 years. It's you're at an inflection point where it's not about another $5 or $10 million that you're going to be making, but it's much more what you're going to leave behind. It's much more what are you doing for the young generations, the new entrepreneurs, the new leaders that are coming in, and what you're passing on to them. So I think this sharing of what you have gone through, hard times, tough times, the learning that you've gone through, and this theme is coming up across a number of the senior executive, both from the private sector and the government sector. And I think it's as important as the millions more that you could be making.
Well, Constantine, thank you so much. Is there any last piece of advice you wanted to leave us with as we close this amazing interview?
No, I would end up with, I mean, you probably have heard it throughout the speech. First, I enjoyed very much, Shane. It's everything is about the passion. You live this life with passion. It's a short life that you have. You know, live it as if today is your last day. And if you do it and you put your heart into it, you align it with your own spirituality and you put it to the service of the community, you're a blessed person. So thank you for this opportunity. I hope it was of use to our listeners, and I wish everybody all the best. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Constantine. Hopefully we can have you out again sometime soon. That was Constantine Salome, Group CEO of Al Ghurair Investments. They own Mashreq Bank, Oman Insurance. They have so many companies. You can check them out online. Abdulaziz Al Ghurair is one of the iconic businessmen businessmen here in the nation, and the Al Ghurair group of businesses is without question a foundation stone in the economy of Dubai and possibly even the UAE. But coming up, you know, as amazing as that interview was, coming up we have Faisal Hussain, the chief executive officer of Syncron. This is an amazing story. I mean, this company did not exist in 2000. He started it in 2001, and today it's worth, it has a gross revenue of over 200 million US dollars, has over 4,000 employees, operates in 9 countries, and it's only just the beginning of the success that's on the road for this company. He's going to be talking about how he did it and how, you know, what his secrets to success are. It's really one episode, you know, you don't want to miss. This is going to be an amazing interview. I'm blessed just to be here tonight. It's really exciting.